Thank you for listening in, and welcome back to episode 4 of Better Breath Than Dead. This is Ivan.
And this is David.
And today we are going to touch on a couple of specific topics. We are going to talk about the recent rise in social consciousness and what we think might be the embryo of a more class-conscious radical movement. And we're going to talk about some very fundamental concepts of class, class reconciliation, class differences, and really try to tie together the things we've talked about the last 3 episodes before we move on to further projects and further topics.
I think most people would ask at this point, you know, how does social class apply to the modern world? When most people think of social class and class consciousness, they're going to think of conditions in the 18th and 19th centuries, you know, Charles Dickens type scenarios where the landed gentry were also the owners of the factories. There were no real safety requirements. There was no minimum wage. There was no minimum age limit for the employees. So you'd have entire families going to work just to make rent. And, you know, we have gone through multiple workers' struggles. We have an extensive history of strikes and unionization. And most people would probably say at this point in time that those struggles have been won for the most part. And that doesn't really apply to the modern world. While things have expanded and we do have more options available to us in the first world, we are still exploited. I mean, more options in the consumer realm does not mean that you have more freedom or control over your work and your daily life experience.
And I think that's an extremely important point in general, that there has been this very steady substitution of what freedom means. It went from being, you know, being free to make your own decisions, being free to earn a decent living, work with dignity, and it's become this concept of freedom of consumption. You're free to choose the product you want. If you want to protest against Apple or Walmart, then you take your business elsewhere. It's implied that you're still going to be a consumer. That's, you know, the principal purpose of most people in the modern economic system is to be a unit of consumption, but you get the choice of where you want to do that consumption. And a lot of the struggles that we've gone through have kind of been leveled down to that point.
Not only that, but I think the average working person in the first world, in the transition from an industrialized work environment to a service sector work environment, is that we are, I would say, because we're working with providing services and selling products, that further disconnects us from the production work, from the value of products, and from the means of production, which definitely, I think, degrades people power to make rational and logical choices about the value of a product, their place in the system as a whole, and just the general management of resources.
Now, I think a big part of that is the notion of most jobs being transitional jobs, that there's talk that it's impossible to unionize fast food workers, for example, because it's such a transitional job. It's something people do for a very short amount of time. You know, call centers, retail, these all jobs that nobody expects to stick around in. And as a result, it's always been accepted that the conditions are terrible in these jobs, but it's okay because, you know, at some point you'll go back to school, you'll move on to another job, or you will, you know, get a decent job at the car factory and it'll be okay. So what happens when economic forces make these jobs not transitional anymore? These jobs make up the majority of what is being done for a living, the majority of labor. So if we're no longer treating them as transitional, what effects does that have on our relationship with capital, our relationship with labor?
Well, I think a big problem that the worker faces is that these positions are still transitional, And I think most people in the workforce has accepted the fact that the classic concept of being able to stick with one company for 20 to 30 years simply doesn't exist anymore. We also have issues with the market in general and volatility in the market. So you don't even know if your job will be there, you know, in 4 to 5 years, let alone 20 to 30 years. I don't think the general public has fully grasped the full ramifications of these changes.
So I guess the logical question stemming from that is, what has so far been, you know, what we've been able to observe in the change in dialogue? To what extent has this, you know, impacted things like the Occupy movement and other sort of soft resistance things that are starting to kind of germinate a little bit?
Well, I think the issue that comes up in this transitional environment is that no one really grabs a solid enough foothold to properly ascertain the value of their work in these service environments, especially if people continuously move between positions every couple of years. They really aren't able to develop the work-oriented relationships that someone is going to be able to develop at a workplace over the course of, you know, 5 to 10 years. They won't develop knowledge of the products and the services provided so that they have enough information to make, you know, rational and educated decisions about real changes that would need to be made in their field. I think that's a very dangerous thing. And the investment classes have been able to use that to their advantage, not only through continuously shifting people with jobs with the enticement and the concept that, you know, if you keep looking, something better is going to come up for you. And with now outsourcing jobs to other countries and generally a shrinking workforce, not only through economic changes, but changes in basic technology. I think the average worker, the proletariat, they're kind of rocked back on their heels. Just they're barely able to keep up with it.
Yeah, I think you're definitely on the point there. And it leads to this very concerning development for the last, you know, 30 years or so, maybe a bit more than that, of almost all worker struggles and class struggles have been almost entirely defensive in nature. The unions where they are, in the instances where they are legitimately pushing for better work conditions, are almost always trying to defend existing gains or make extremely modest demands. There's very little of the idea that it's okay to go out and demand better conditions, that it's okay to demand, you know, a more dignified work existence. And a lot of cases, the transitional nature is really a weapon against that, because a lot of people don't feel the emotional investment in one service job. So if that job turns out to be terrible, then they'll move on to another one. You know, people go from working at one retail store to another, or they go from one fast food joint to another, one call center to another. You get people who have worked in the same type of job for years and years and years, but in 8 different places. Because there's not enough of an emotional attachment to any one of them to make it worth sticking out. And even if you did and you're the only one, you know, odds are you're just going to get fired in any event. It's not worth suing the company for a wrongful termination at McDonald's. You know, it happens every single day.
Well, another interesting thing that come to mind is that when people do bring up you know, social issues, it's generally outside of the workplace. And when they talk about fair trade, it's from the consumer standpoint. It's, you know, they're talking about sweatshops in third world countries, you know, that employ child labor. They're talking about, you know, farmers that are oppressed by their local governments, like even in mundane things like the coffee trade or the production of chocolate, things of that nature. People rarely talk about the issues that we currently have with employment, wages, and just the de-skilling of the modern workforce through the outsourcing of the American job, through the lack of education and training. And I would argue very strongly that this is all part of the natural process of the system of capital and the monopolization of capital. Not only that, but the fact that the federal government has backed away from using its powers, such as the antitrust laws, to stop these things from happening. Because I would argue very strongly that these are all symptoms of the hegemony of capital and basically the owners of the methods of production.
Absolutely. And I think this is one of the moments where we have to step back and realize that in the end, while the state can occupy a role as sort of the mediator between the proletarian class and the capitalist class, fundamentally the existing state is still, at the end of the day, a capitalist state. So I don't think it should come as a surprise when, in the end, it serves the interest of capital. While it will make concessions to the working class when those concessions are vigorously fought for and struggled for. I think for a long time there was the ideal that it could be differently. You know, in America you had the concept of the Great Society. You had the movements of social democracy in Northwestern Europe. And I think in recent years it's become very evident, especially in the last few years since the economic crisis, that those methods, because they rely on the state conceding these things as opposed to the working class militantly agitating for them, that they will ultimately be pushed back and repealed. Whether that happens through austerity measures, whether it happens through the need to slash social services to service the national debt, or whether it happens, as we've seen in Greece, probably some of the most aggressive attacks on working class standards, and some of the most aggressive moves in favor of capital. It's turning out, I think, that the standard liberal progressive idea of putting their hope in the existing state and hoping that if we just vote the right way, somehow we will end up with a worker state or even just a progressive state, is extremely vulnerable to, you know, the thing that makes everything go around, which at the moment is capital.
Well, I think the major issue with this, the relationship between capital and a government, is the fact that a government still has to use money, especially at this point with the powers of the Federal Reserve and the fact that it is a private institution. They are regulated by the government, but governments don't control economics. I think with the last financial crisis that came up, people really started to grasp that governments across the world really aren't the people that are controlling the situation. They're merely players in the situation. They're trying to deal with the economic climate and economic changes just like everyone else. So if they try, whenever there is a situation that comes up where a government would try to put their foot down and stop a company, you know, or totally change the trajectory and path of a certain economic process, that they're stopped efforts are slowed down just because the more action they take against the economics, a company in particular, in effect, they're going to be taking action against the entire economic system. And because it's all so interrelated at this point in history, it's going to slow the whole system down. I think that's probably a big part of the problem with trying to enact the antitrust laws, because it can have a negative impact. So now, at this juncture in history, due to the interrelated nature of capital the financial institutions and big business, essentially the government, which were the classic mediators between the general public and corporate power. They've been disempowered and they're kind of locked down by the financial system that they trumpeted as the driving engine of progress in society.
And this is speaking of situations where elements of government have not been flat out subverted or have willingly sold themselves out to corporate interest, which I think at this point is pretty much a 50-50 proposition.
And we're talking about mainly regulatory agencies. The FDA is a big one. Obviously, the issues with Monsanto, the bioengineering of crops, all the different chemicals they've introduced to expand the yield of agricultural crops, just the general corruption in factory farming is, I think if people saw these practices 50 years ago, they would be terrified of how these processes and how the entire industry has changed. I mean, this is a basic component of the health of the entire country and a large portion of the world, considering how much America produces.
And I think we're at a point now where slowly, inch by inch, this awareness is starting to materialize. And it's still very fumbling and grasping and stumbling. But I think there is, perhaps it's starting with the realization that the classic American dream capitalism is not only not happening, but it probably won't ever happen again. The interests are too strong. The corporate players are too strong. The niche have all been covered. Everything that can be capitalized and financialized has been. And people are realizing that we're on a, we're not progressing, we're regressing. We're talking about the first generations, in the West that'll be measurably worse off than their parents and their grandparents were. And I think there's this slowly starting to be an awareness of this. You're starting to see, the mainstream media actually address concepts like income inequality. And of course, the mainstream media is primarily a corporate outlet. They can't provide the answer, the solution to that question. But the fact that it's starting to enter consciousness, you're starting to see things like the Occupy movement, and even to an extent, misguided as you might otherwise judge them, the Tea Party movement, that there's starting to be mass awareness that something is messed up.
Well, and the classic concept of the American dream is based off the idea that everyone has a fair footing in the race to grow wealthy and to live a full and prosperous life. Of course, the basic components of the history of the world show otherwise. Power has always been consolidated, and once someone is able to consolidate a position of power, it's not like then that is at the time of their death that's then diced up and taken back in by the government to be distributed fairly and equitably to the rest of the community so that a whole new generation can start. No, that obviously has never been the case. I think people on the right, people in the Tea Party, like to think that the free market engenders kind of an open system and an open playing field where people can work together, come up with their own ideas, and push their own concepts. But that's just not real. It's not what's happening in the real world. I mean, more often you see Walmart coming in, wiping out the local businesses. You see restaurants like Denny's and IHOP moving in, taking out the small restaurants in an area. And that's very well documented. I mean, now, you have also questions of, class. With the different classes of stores available, you have Walmart providing one type of product, at a discount for certain groups of people. It's made by exploited Chinese labor. And then you have higher class stores, for instance, like good example that comes to mind is like New Seasons and the health food stores. They obviously cater to people that are at a higher class economically and can afford those products. And well, everyone else is going to be eating hot dogs and top ramen, apparently. And it's just their own fault, of course, because they didn't have the wherewithal to, you know, to reach the higher echelons of the economic system.
And I think this really brings us to the conclusion of our first part, which is, as these things are kind of happening, as more and more people are realizing that, you know, the economic system is impossibly larger than any person or any state can imagine, that the democratic institutions that we've established over the past couple hundred years can be brought to their knees by the needs of capital. The idea that capitalism has transcended the nation state, it's almost ridiculous to talk about an American company at this point because they're, you know, so broadly based, so broadly traded. You know, multinationals are driving a lot of economic push. The banking system is so large that there is not enough money in the world to bail out, you know, the entire banking system should we get to that point. With that, I think more and more people are slowly becoming aware of these things, which brings up a lot of questions. I don't think right now we're necessarily at a point where there is enough, there's certainly not enough class consciousness, and I think there's not enough mass outrage yet to get, bring us to one of these kind of historical flashpoints where things change, where we enter a period of upheaval, and where hopefully we can influence things for the better. But it brings up probably a very central question, one we're going to examine in a future episode, which is it possible to reform the system into what we want, you know, by exerting democratic pressure on the system, by electing the right types of politicians, and by electing the right kinds of people in the right positions? Is it possible we can reform our way to a, you know, a fairer, more equitable system? Can we vote our way into a socialist system, or can we vote our way to, you know, capitalism with a human face? Or must these things come through in a more drastic way, you know, the traditional revolutionary period, the traditional violent upheaval? And is it possible to obtain that element of class reconciliation? You know, a lot of times, and you'll hear politicians say this on TV, that it's not the time for class warfare, or we should get beyond or past these things. And the insinuation is that we can all come together. We shouldn't rock the boat too much. It's possible for the workers' interests and the capitalists' interests to coincide with each other. And it's possible that if the company gives a little and if the worker gives a little, everybody can be happy and the capitalists make lots of money and the worker can make a little bit less money. And it all kind of flows along.
Well, I think that's an interesting point. I think one thing that the classical socialist economic thinkers didn't really take into account was that the capitalists could make compromises. They would be willing to shorten hours for workers, and that they would be willing to pay them a higher wage, to actually pay them a living wage, to give them health care benefits, to give them paid time off, to give them sick leave, to actually take care of their employees. The big classic theories put forth by Engels and Marx and their contemporaries were that, you know, well, for one, they believed that the capitalist system would collapse within their own lifetimes, you know, within a period of, well, maybe 50 years. But that was based off the circumstances of their time. With collective bargaining came kind of the integration. The interesting thing we've seen in the last 10 to 20 years, I think it's based off the world market and the fact that, and we weren't working just within the United States anymore, and so we capitalists could manipulate lower quality of life in other countries in the third world so that they could bypass the agreements that had been made with the labor movement in prior decades.
Right. I think the part that very few of the classic political thinkers really anticipated was the ability and willingness of capital to make concessions when pushed to a sufficient point. When you look at some of the, you know, classic labor union gains, like the 40-hour work week or sick leave or paid time off or minimum wage laws or an end to child labor, these were all things that were brutally fought and repressed until a point where it couldn't be repressed any longer, and it was conceded, because in the end, they didn't significantly affect the ability of capital to function. They might cut into the profit slightly, but it's better to lose a little bit of your profit than to lose all of it. And I think that's been a really significant driving force for the idea of, you know, capitalism with a human face again, that it's possible to reform it enough that it becomes an equitable system for everybody. Usually, of course, this holds true if you look in a very, very narrow situation. If you are your average office worker in Norway, life is fundamentally pretty good and capitalism doesn't seem so bad, but your food was still harvested by slave labor in Indonesia. The system has never changed. It just gained the ability to push the unsavory elements out of sight. And with that, it also gained the ability to retract the gains that were made, because labor can now, you know, is fully global. Just like the economy is fully global, labor is just another commodity that is traded for any other commodity in the market.
Of course, the dark side of that is you're dealing with human beings. These are, you know, and based off the Christian values, at least, the American capitalist oftentimes likes to pretend that he bases his decision-making off of. I mean, there's a definite contradiction in the actions of these people and essentially their PR campaigns.
And more so than that, I think it points to the fundamental contradiction. This is almost the core. If you only ever knew one thing about Marxism, this is the one thing to know. The fundamental contradiction between, you know, workers and the owners is that their interests can never both be satisfied. The worker is always going to be have as his interest to earn a larger share of the value he creates. And in reality, that's what we're talking about. We're not talking about earning more than you're worth. We're talking about earning what you produce or a larger share of it. And he's always going to want to earn that by working less in better conditions. The owner is always going to maximize profit, which can happen only by paying less for more hours. That's, I think, the fundamental contradiction that stands in the way of every other attempt to reconcile the differences, whether we muddy the waters with, you know, the much talked about middle class, whether we appeal to religious morality, whether we appeal to constitutional protections. In the end, none of these can accommodate that contradiction.
And with that, I believe we will be ending our episode. And we'd greatly appreciate you tuning in today and giving a socialist commentary at least a chance. Next episode, we will be discussing in more detail the ramifications of revolutionary methods and means and possible outcomes.
Thank you for tuning in, comrades.